Aye. Kenneth Clark, Member of Parliament for Rushcliffe in Nottinghamshire, Secretary of State for Education from 1990 to 1992. I was the last appointment that Margaret Thatcher made, because in the short interval between Geoffrey Howe's resignation and the fall of Margaret Thatcher, she made a little reshuffle to fill the gap that Geoffrey Howe had left, and she, with great difficulty, persuaded me to move from health to education.
So it was quite a surprise.
And then I immediately found that we were into a leadership contest, and I didn't actually do anything for the first fortnight, explaining to my officials that I was totally immersed in internal politics, and there was absolutely no point in my starting to do anything in the department till I discovered whether the new Prime Minister would keep me at education or not. So I didn't really start for about a fortnight until John had got himself elected, and John confirmed straight away he wanted me to carry on to education. And that's when I really started.
Thank you. Can I take you back to your own school days and ask you whether you enjoyed your history lessons when you were at school or not?
Yeah, I was then a history buff, and I remain so. And this is at my secondary school. I was at Nottingham High School. I had got there on a local authority scholarship. It was a very good private day school. The more I went on, the more I enjoyed history. I always enjoyed history. By the time I got to the sixth form, I was really a historian, as it were, and medieval history was the curriculum I chose for my A-level history. So I was very into medieval British and European history. Indeed, I had a charismatic history teacher. Everybody looks back and is very grateful to particular teachers. And there was a man called David Peters, who taught his History Sixth. And he was a very, very good teacher, and he encouraged my interest in history, encouraged me to get into Cambridge on the strength of my history. Although I then made the mistake of going to Cambridge and switching to read law for utilitarian reasons, to the great annoyance of the college who'd admitted me as a historian. The man who was very cross became a great friend of mine afterwards, but he always complained that I had let him down by not reading history and going off to do law. The atmosphere of the school was brought back to me very vividly by a recent play by Bennett, History Boys, which I went to see. It was absolutely, the whole atmosphere was exactly like my days in Nottingham High School, the informal relationship between the master and the boys, and these sort of rather irkish youths, all in a school which was actually an academic sweatshop, which was all, the whole object of life was to get an open award of some kind at an Oxbridge college. But we were a lot of provincial lads. The only difference being that, unlike this other subplot in History Boys, David Peters was straight, happily married, and there was simply no question of any. You didn't have to worry about David Peters that way. He was just a very good, hard-driving teacher, getting us all to focus on which Cambridge colleagues we were going to get into, or Oxford College.
So, what would you say history's importance is in the school curriculum?
Well, I just think the whole point of education is not just utilitarian. It is to produce civilised, rounded people who can contribute to a strong, healthy society. And I do think to have a proper understanding of history is a very good grounding in understanding your society, understanding civilised values. I very much regret that the level of knowledge of British history seems to me to have deteriorated. I sometimes say we've now reached a stage where the British are very proud of their history, but most of them know very little about it. They appear to a fascination with the Second World War, and a knowledge of the Tudors, because they're always appearing on television, is becoming the limit of too many people's knowledge. I'm extremely glad that I had the grounding in history I had at school, which has never left me. I now narrow my mind in my reading. I only read history and biography, and more historic, and I don't read much current autobiography and so on. But I do read. That's all I ever have time to read. I'm ashamed to say I've given up reading fiction absolutely entirely. And I, you know, when I have time to read when I'm at Kennington, I've got a Life of Pitt the Elder on the go at the moment. Just finished one I've got Aristotle and a fresh one in Nottingham. There's always a history book or a biography. by my side in Nottingham and London.
It's quite surprising, really, isn't it, that the public has a great appetite for history, even though...
A section of the public does, yes. Although, unfortunately, there are a lot of people still interested in history. But I think you can tell amongst your political colleagues which of them actually have any proper sense of history and read about it or know anything about it. And those that don't, there are some very leading politicians who plainly know no history at all. And others, like William Hague, who produce very good historical work.
Just going back to your appointment, you were quite surprised to be transferred from health to education. So what was expected of you in the new post?
To liven up and revive the pace of Ken Baker's reforms. I did resist moving from health to education. The only time I ever had a conversation with Margaret Thatcher when I was naked, because she ran me up in the... junior minister. I got out of the bath and answered the phone, stood there dripping, arguing the toss about whether David Mellor was going to be taken away from me when I was at health. Now, it was more face-to-face conversation with Margaret when she made this move. I resisted, not because I had anything... Life would be Secretary of State for Education in a year or two's time if she wanted. We were on the point of beginning the implementation of the health reforms, which I had been developing and then arguing about for the previous two or three years. And this was November, I think. The reforms were due to start in April. And my argument was, Margaret, you can't possibly move me now. I've been wading through blood for the last two or three years. I obviously know more about it than anybody else in the team. But to take me away on the eve of implementing it is just crazy. And we don't even know sure that it's going to work when we switch it on. So just keep me next April. If it doesn't work, you can fire me. But I just wanted now to see it through to the beginnings of delivery. And then I asked her, well, who are you bringing into the cabinet? We've got to have a new cabinet minister. And she said, William Waldegrave. And I said, quite genuinely, excellent. You know, it should have been the cabinet ages ago. Excellent. You know, I'm delighted to have William coming into the cabinet. I cannot think of a more obvious Secretary of State for Education. He's an extremely educated, erudite guy. William would love to be Secretary of State for Education. Why don't you make William Secretary of State for Education? And she said, my dear boy, I can't make an Etonian Secretary of State for Education. And that was her killer argument. I gave up then. And so I went to education. And within a week, she was out of office. And as I already told you, I therefore had a slight hiatus whilst we sorted out the leadership. Then I started the job seriously and greatly enjoyed it. It's a very good job being Secretary of State, a very important job being Secretary of State for Education.
What were the key issues?
Oh, why was she gave me that explanation, which was one explanation. I'd tell you why I worked out after why she'd moved me and moved us as we did. She thought that she always regarded me as a troubleshooter or something. She always sent me to places where the controversy was most ferocious. And she'd reached a stage where we'd done, she thought, all the heavy lifting had been done on health reform. She now wanted somebody who would quieten it down. She thought she wanted to launch it with somebody who would actually be a little free of the controversy, and therefore William could guide it in a statesmanlike way. That was her motive. Education, she was a keen supporter of Ken Baker's reforms. Unfairly, probably, she thought they had stalled under John McGregor, and John was being too conciliatory and not enough was visibly happening. And so she actually wanted me to go and liven education up. And to get on with it, she knew I was a keen supporter of Ken's reforms. That's why she moved me to education, although she never admitted that to me. That didn't come out in the conversation. She wanted me to go and take on the educational establishment in the way she thought I'd taken on the health establishment. Well, they're my opinion, they'd take me on, but that was...
So what were the key issues related to the national curriculum which faced you when you were...
It was on the point of being introduced. It was all in place. One of the concessions Ken had made had been that the curriculum would be drawn up by large committees of very distinguished people. This was a response to understandable fears that you couldn't have politicians drawing up a curriculum because they politicise it. So the great and the good are going to draw up the curriculum. This had not worked, in my opinion. One problem was the great and the good had given in to every lobby that wanted to put something in the curriculum. All kinds of interest groups were much keener on politicising it with a small p than any of us were. And so the curriculums were all huge. All kinds of things put in, which some people, for extremely worthy reasons, thought should be taught to every pupil. We still have this problem, you know, all the things they've got to be taught about. So they were enormous. What is more, that part of the educational establishment of which I disapproved had plainly dominated this. So the content of the curriculum was remarkably vacuous at times. The one obsession of the educational establishment was you were not going for rote learning, you were developing and enlarging minds at the pace they wished to go. So the history curriculum was one of the worst. You could fulfil the history curriculum without taking any attention to the events of history or historical perspective, empathising with the social conditions of people of various ages was regarded as much more important than actually what was described by people who disagreed with me as kings and battles history. That was the jargon used by people on the left. We weren't to be taught about kings and battles. You were to be taught about evolution of society over the ages, and the document was extremely vacuous. And I decided we'd gone too far with all this. It happened. History was one of the most interesting, but it was true of various others. And I'm afraid I insisted on rewriting them. We're not going to have this. All the draft curriculums I got, not one of them required that any of the pupils should display any knowledge of anything. The requirement that you curriculum might establish in part knowledge of anything, that implied rote learning. You weren't just getting people to recite facts. Hence you could do a history curriculum without necessarily knowing anything about the things you were commenting on and empathising with. I tried to alter all this, and we practically rewrote with the assistance of various officials, and they probably got people from outside to help. We actually produced a more orthodox history curriculum, going through, it was British history, but it was going through the...
Do you mean the revisions made by the National Curriculum Council? History Council?
The National Curriculum Council, the people I'm complaining about.
History Working Group.
The History Working Group, yes. We must have got I can't remember the extraction now. Did we get the National Curriculum Council to buy our rewrite? I actually took part in sitting down and rewriting some of it with my officials.
With civil
the stuff we got from the working group. I had the same problem with geography. The geography curriculum did not seem to require you to know where anything anywhere was or anything about foreign countries. You need to know all about climate change and the industrial pollution and all this kind of thing. And when I started trying, I think quite reasonably, and I had everything in too antediluvian a fashion to challenge that, I was told I was trying to get them to teach Capes and Bays history. They were against that. It didn't matter if people didn't know where Australia was and they got sheep or anything like that. That was old-fashioned Victorian stuff. If you remember, the unions rapidly began to attack me as Secretary of State on the basis that I wanted to bring back blackboards and rote learning. Blackboards were a symbol of Victorian education. I couldn't care less whether you had blackboards. I never mentioned blackboards. I've never learned everywhere. But they said I wanted to bring back blackboards and Victorian teaching. And what I was doing was rewriting the history curriculum, the geography curriculum, I remember, the music curriculum.
So hours and hours spent with your officials actually making revisions, or did you just suggest revisions and they went away?
I don't remember sitting there with pen in hand, although I might have done. But what happened was we'd go through bits and we'd discuss what we were going to do with this, and then, as you say, officials would go away and produce drafts and submit them to me and rewrite. We pretty well rewrote the first proposals from the working party, which were on my desk when I arrived. I just would not put that out. It seemed to me that we were going to lower the standards of history teaching in schools where they did teach history if we weren't careful putting all this out. And I couldn't imagine that Mr. Peters would have had much time for all this.
But The civil servants who were responsible for that, were they people like Jenny Bacon who were involved, and Roger Hennessy who were involved in
can't remember. I mean, I changed HMI to Mariah. I created Ofsted. Can't remember. That Jenny Bacon's a name I remember, but I can't remember. My memory for names is very bad. I recognise them when I meet them. So the number of officials of the Department of Education whose names I can remember, but that can get worse as I get older. Very few. So I'm not sure which team they were. That was another thing about the department. HMI was at the heart of policy making. I got fed up with HMI. I wanted an inspectorate. Something to do with quality and standards, get some consistency across the system and get back some structured teaching into the schools of a reasonable curriculum. I didn't want it to be too prescriptive. There was too much in it. I had great difficulty, which was not very successful, in thinning it out because it was utterly, you know, sort of hugely burdensome as curriculums were being produced. HMI regarded their principal role as having an input into policy. They were the part of the department regarded HMI as a policy-making body. I regarded HMI as people who were, you know, on the ground helping to raise standards in schools. Of course, the actual amount of inspecting they were doing was quite small. A teacher could go through almost the entire of his or her career and never have a visit by HMI. And they regarded this as a kind of, you know, kind of boring stuff for the weaker members of HMI, and HMI's lofty role was policy making. As most of their policy suggestions were ones that I didn't agree with, I just got irritated by them when I brought in, what's his name, Chris Woodhead, and created Ofsted and all this kind of thing.
The issue of the overcrowded curriculum was part of it, as you've referred to. Part of your decision making was to make history and geography optional after the age of 14. Can you recall how that decision was reached?
I was persuaded of that. I don't sure with hindsight, it's a pity in a way I did that. It was because we were, as with all reforms of those days, still not so much nowadays, the atmosphere has changed. I mean, all reform was greeted with horrendous root and branch opposition. It was just like health, exactly the same sort of people who were determined to make sure nothing happened. And one of their strongest arguments, which you may gather I had some sympathy with, was this was hopelessly overloaded. You could not expect this to be done. So it had to leave some discretion to schools. When it came to what we were going to... The reason for having a curriculum was that the curriculum in some of the weaker and odder schools had become most peculiar, being left to every head teacher, you know, finding... I'm sure it was fine in 90% of cases, but you could find weak schools that really, you know, were not in any organised way teaching quite important things, and all kinds of bizarre local oddities would crop up. But I accepted the argument you had to leave some flexibility, and some schools said they couldn't teach this organised history and geography because they hadn't got anybody who could teach it, the more formalised stuff we were now producing. And so I'd slightly regret that I was persuaded to make those optional. It's gone further since. I mean, now we've got optional foreign languages, optional, you know, specific science, all of which I think we've gone far too far.
Would you now support restoring history?
Well, because I'm so fond of history, I'm probably biased. I mean, if I was... I never pretended I was a benign dictator, so left to myself, just able to sit there and peremptorily issue instructions, yes, I would have made... I'd make history compulsory for all people of all ages. But I slightly regret having been persuaded that the two we had to make optional were history and geography. But of course, it was the history, it was the organised end. I suspect they were not genuinely representative of the history teachers and the geography teachers, who were amongst my most vehement opponents, the whole idea anyway, where we had got history teachers. I attended meetings of the geography teachers, I remember being worse, but they were, you know, extraordinarily vehement.
You mean against the national curriculum?
Yes, about against being asked to teach facts. The real argument was that the curriculum I was insisting on involved teaching of imparting of knowledge to the pupils. This was regarded, and it sounds comic now, one forgets just what the zany left had become like in the 1980s. it was regarded as Victorian to insist that education was about imparting knowledge in the terms of dry old facts. I won't burden you with English, that was the same. We weren't going to teach, we couldn't teach dead white European males about, cut out quite a lot of English literature, which the vehement ones didn't want to teach. The music curriculum, they thought I'd be all right on that because it had a lot of references to jazz. I quite like the references to jazz. I pointed out that though the word jazz occurred several times, it was outnumbered by references to reggae, which was all over the place. Reggae dominated the constituency. And though I'm not a particular enthusiast for classical Western European music, it struck me as an odd curriculum which had one passing reference to what people normally call classical music. The working party had produced a curriculum which didn't involve classical music. It was all about jazz was the good bit, but otherwise more popular culture, and most particularly reggae. Whoever dominated the drafting of it was also obsessed with reggae, which was then a fashionable Caribbean music.
The big argument, as I recall from the history point of view, was over whether you could test knowledge or not.
Yes, because this was rote learning, this was Victorian testing. Was a great argument all the way through. The SATs, the assessments, were statutory and were unsettled. But when I arrived, what had not been settled was whether they should be made public. The results should be made public. And my officials, implored me to stop referring to them as tests. The unions had been assured that we weren't having testing. It was ludicrous. It was just using impenetrable language. So I cheerily described them as tests, national tests at set key stages. And I also insisted that we were going to publish the results. We'd not in the league tables, and although I must admit it was quite obvious that the press would put them into league tables, but that we'd produce all the results from schools, and then, of course, what the press do is resettle them and start producing league orders. But the idea that the outcome of these tests should remain a kind of closed subject, away from Freedom of Information Acts or classified, in effect. The results of the test should only be known to the people, to the teachers concerned, not to the parents, not to the public, was one of the big arguments I had, and I introduced. They were trying to stop them. The unions were trying to stop proceeding. I was lobbied like mad to stop SATs, to drop SATs. Not only did I insist on going ahead with SATs, not only did I also refer to them as tests when I was in speeches, but I insisted that they were going to be public and we were going to publish them.
Actually, the tests in history didn't happen in the end, did they?
Did they delay them?
They didn't.
Well, you looked it up, and I'm going on my memory of events of 18 years ago. Why were they postponed? Can you remember?
Basically, they proved unwieldy to have too many tests, so they settled for English, Maths and Science.
When was that?
After you left office under John Paton.
Yeah, it sounds like somebody was persuaded that it was frightfully stressful and burdensome to have them all at once.
They were prepared, but they didn't actually use them.
Yeah, if they were prepared, it sounds as though it wasn't my decision to postpone them.
No, I think it was your success. The other issue that arose during your period in relation to the history national curriculum was current affairs, and this issue of whether history should be taught up to the current day.
Well, this was because, again, quite a lot of schools were not teaching very recognisable history, and history lessons. I've attended history lessons which were all about current affairs, which was what we had quite serious arguments. And I introduced this 20-year rule, which was the only crude way of tackling it.
Can you recall the meeting when that happened and how it came about?
I can't recall individual meetings. I can recall the debate. We drew up a curriculum which didn't go into modern times, and then found that the then obsession, the fashion amongst, I hate to politicise it, but it was the more left-wing end of the profession, was to teach mainly about Ireland. The history of the struggle of the Irish people against British oppression, and particularly brought bang up to date with, you know, why the IRA weren't behaving as they were and all this sort of thing. Apart from the sensitivity of this dominating lessons, as on the whole we were concentrating on contemporary events, I didn't think this should count, whatever else you did. I didn't mind current affairs. I'm all in favour of current affairs, including, I think teachers nowadays get almost too worried about being thought to be partisan and so on. But in those days, they weren't too bothered about that. But, I mean, the whole thing was being taken over by slightly politicised current affairs. I once visited a school, I remember, where the history teacher was aware of this issue must have broken out already, the 20-year thing. So I sat in at a lesson at the invitation of this teacher. And it was all about Chinaman Square. And it was pretty obvious to me what he had in mind. Firstly, he was quite defiantly teaching a lesson about Chinaman Square. But he thought I was motivated solely by political prejudice, that so long as he was teaching about something that was hostile to the People's Republic of China, I wouldn't mind that. He just assumed that my only objection was to any politics I disagreed with. And so, having an unfashionable, still fashionable contempt for politicians, he thought, so long as it's something right-wing, he won't mind. I wasn't. I didn't fall out with the individual teacher, but I just thought it was ridiculous that the whole history lesson had been taken up with what was largely based on the videos of Tiananmen Square. And I'm afraid I was old-fashioned enough, because old-fashioned was what I was always accused of, to think that whatever else this was, it was not a history lesson. And hence the 20-year rule.
And do you think that was the best of all the options that we discussed? I mean, having a finishing date as opposed to a moving date?
It was the only one that was not going to be a continuing case of, you know, all the others were too flexible. We're actually nominally changing things, but we're plainly going to be ignored by my opponents in practice. It was, of course, simplistic. I kind of rolled in 20 years. It was childishly simplistic. But it was certain. It was clear and established the point. And most of the alternatives were attempts to water down this disinclination to allow teaching current affairs to be regarded as history. It's not pure semantics. I don't think a lesson about Tiananmen Square then, when it was quite a recent event, was a history lesson. Wasn't.
If you connected with it, I mean, the argument used at the time was, well, you can teach about the building of the Berlin Wall, but we can't teach about the ending of the Berlin Wall. You know, it's the connection between historical events and contemporary.
Yes, well, I think I did have some conversations with this teacher with whom I didn't fall out, but, you know, it's something about the background to Tiananmen Square. If they had been given, you know, something, I can't remember how old the children were, they were quite senior secondary school pupils, I think. You know, so why not start with the Boxer Rebellion? And, I mean, because the average British citizen's knowledge of China is nil. From those days, it was minus zero. I wouldn't have had the faintest objection. And if the guy had insisted on, you know, British involvement with China, putting it, I wouldn't mind, the Opium War, which is one of the more disgraceful episodes in our history. I didn't go along with Margaret's slight inclination to want to teach patriotic enthusiasm. I was actually very much against the curriculum being used to impart political views. I'm a libertarian on all those things. But it was ludicrous. With no background, he was just not a very good lesson, and explaining to people what had happened in Tiananmen Square, I think only a year or two earlier.
In terms of the factual information that you felt people should have, would you say it should have been predominantly British, or there should have been these wider topics?
I'd have liked to widen it, but that was too ambitious in some cases. I mean, if you didn't have a very strong history curriculum in too many schools, obviously the best schools of all kinds were teaching very good history. What we were worried about was the very long tail, which is still a great worry in British education, but this has moved on. And it was trying to get some structured history into schools which weren't teaching it. And a part of the resistance was, you know, some teachers couldn't teach it. You have some misfortune there, that they really would have to keep reading ahead of the class to deal with what they were teaching. Sorry, what was the question? I forgot.
It's really whether you thought that the specified information that children should learn should be predominantly British, or should embrace...
Well, we wound up with it being British because it was not practical going to wider. My belief, it should be internationalised a bit.
You've always
it was not widely shared. I couldn't get many supporters for that. Nobody thought that was practical.
Because of the limits on the time.
And of course, those that wanted political input, which I strongly and vehemently insist, did not include me, but included quite a lot of my critics and opponents, were as obsessed with British history as the patriotic right. If what you really were trying to impart was the struggle of the working class through the ages, you were equally dominated by a desire to get into British history. And you may think I sound like a reactionary old colonel parodying the left in those ways, but the history of the Thatcher years, looking back, and I wasn't as controversial. I think we have forgotten just how amazing the left were. We had gone through a 10, 15-year period in which the most extraordinary attitudes had taken hold in sections of society, and I'm afraid in the educational establishment quite strongly. They were a minority, but they were the vocal minority who turned up at the meetings and had an input into things like the curriculum, which, of course, it was a great opportunity, as they saw it, to change education as well, but they weren't going in the same direction as me, that was for sure.
Do you think that the curriculum that you brought in had a dramatic effect on the teaching history?
I don't know. It'd be very interesting to see whether your survey, whether people think it did. Having been Secretary of State for Education, I have not judgments of that kind, which are quite interesting with hindsight, historical perspective. My honest confession is I haven't had the time to come to a clear conclusion. I hope so. I think as the teaching of any ordinary history had become extinct in some schools, it cannot have done a great deal of harm. I hope it spread a more structured approach to history and more pupils having some teaching in British history. That was the whole point, was extended.
Over the years since you introduced the first national curriculum, there have been revisions.
Yes.
And those have generally increased the flexibility to teachers.
Well, flexibility is always demanded. In a normal circumstance of a reasonable school, one's in favour of flexibility is the next person. But I think we had taken over a situation when Ken came along, was appointed in the late 80s, where flexibility was all very well, but flexibility was being allowed to produce an increasingly inadequate and poor and slightly offbeat form of education in some of these specific areas. So the critics, up to this day, still demand flexibility, which means they don't want to be accountable for what they teach, and they wish to pursue their own personal instincts on the curriculum and don't like any of it being prescribed in any way. And an element of prescription, I believed when I was Secretary of State, was undoubtedly necessary because the teaching of history was deteriorating rapidly.
Hopefully it has improved since.
I think it probably has. But I still don't think there's knowledge of history of any kind amongst the British population. It's very good.
Maybe it takes a very long time.
A close circle of my friends are the only people with whom you can have a sort of serious conversation about history, usually, unless it's the Tudors. Everyone knows Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, or thinks they do. Outside of that, complete mystery. The English Civil War, most people used to talk about the English Civil War, but most people don't know we had one. I won't go on, but I do still have slightly crusty views that the role of history in our education has been diminished and ought to be increased.
Thank you very much, Mr. Twelve.